Hey everyone, this is Joe.
And this is Ryan.
And this is Wes.
And this is Will.
It's me, Wesley.
Yeah.
Wes is not here.
Yeah.
But that's okay, we're going to soldier on without him. This is the Nintendo Show, the best damn Nintendo podcast on the internet. This is a Nintendo 64 edition of the Nintendo Show.
Is Wes okay?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure he's okay. He's got, like, his age just got really bad. He's got,
Yeah,
it's a big old flare of AIDS.
Oh, okay, so, it's his AIDS. I mean, well, I'm not glad to hear that, but you know, there were those bombings all over Austin. I figured he was in some way responsible for it.
I'm sure he had a hand in it somewhere.
Ugh.
Yeah. Him and his ISIS beard.
Yeah, you know, he's about that. I don't get it.
Anyway, so in a Nintendo 64 edition of the show, what we do is to talk about retro games as they came out, sort of semi-chronologically, 21 years ago,
yep.
Which would put us in March of 1997.
Right.
And there are a couple of games worth mentioning that came out around that time. One is Turok Dinosaur Hunter for the Nintendo 64, and then there is Blast Corps for the Nintendo 64.
So have you had a chance to clock a substantial amount of time on either of these games?
Not, well, I've spent more time with Blast Corps.
Okay.
But it's the better of the two games, so I want to start with Turok.
Okay.
And Turok came out in March 1997, of course.
Designed to be impossible to play.
Indeed. This one came out on March 4th.
Yeah.
Just some of the
oh, yeah, yeah,
core-like history stuff
right
there. Developed by Iguana Entertainment. You probably know them as primarily as the developer of NBA Jam. They also developed the a sequel to this Turok game.
Yeah, NBA Jam clearly set them up for this kind of game.
Indeed. So, Iguana started out making games, I think kind of in the mid-90s, I believe, is when they started up. Mm-hmm. And they made games for Sunsoft and Acclaim. In 1998, they were bought outright by Acclaim.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when they started just focusing a lot on sports games.
Oh, so, I do recognize this logo. That's a pretty iconic logo.
Yeah, especially like from NBA Jam Tournament Edition. I think it was right on the front there.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1998, they were bought out, and then they went defunct in 2004.
I see that with the Showdown, Legends of Wrestling, and All-Star Baseball.
Yeah, and I think in 1997 in particular, they produced like five or six just sports games. So they're pretty prolific.
Yeah, in 98, you're right. They do NHL, Breakaway, baseball game, Iggy's Wrecking Balls. I don't know what that is. NFL quarterback, another. They had time for two NHL games. No, they just released NHL Breakaway 99, so didn't even bother to wait a whole year before tagging us with another round of NHL.
But something interesting that happens with this studio is that I believe when they are bought out by Acclaim in 98, I think it was, the founder, a man by the name of, stand by, let me see if I can, I don't have a written.
Jeff. Spangenberg?
Yes, thank you. Jeff Spangenberg.
You think he's Jewish?
Probably. So he actually left Acclaim, or left Iguana when they were bought by Acclaim, and he went on to form a development studio called Retro. You might have heard of them.
Retro Studios?
A developer of the Metroid Prime games.
Oh, well, no shit.
Yep.
Very cool.
So
Oh, I see. Yeah, or at least this is heavily involved with Nintendo. It seems like they only do Nintendo.
Right, yeah. Retro Studios, when Retro Studios was formed, they were sort of formed in partnership with Nintendo to develop games for GameCube.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that, I don't know if they were outright owned by Nintendo when they first started up, but now they are just outright owned by Nintendo.
Yeah.
Turok Dinosaur Hunter was, of course, published by Acclaim, as we mentioned before, produced by Mr. Spangenberg, Mr. Jeff, and also produced by Darren Shavington.
Mm-hmm. Sounds English?
Sure does. I know nothing else about him.
Yeah.
But the Turok series is actually based on a comic book, a fictional character in a comic book that started in 1954.
No way. Well, this kind of feels like serial pulp adventure, right? Mm-hmm. You know, it's like a old school trophy hunter gets stuck in World of Dinosaurs.
Yeah, it's like put in the Savage Land somehow.
Yeah.
But, so in 1994, Acclaim bought the studio, the comic book publisher that had the rights to Turok. And so then, by proxy, they became the IP holder for the Turok character.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, quick correction, they did buy Acclaim the same year, in 1994. rather than 1998 that I was saying before. I caught up with my notes here.
So the history books will have to be revised.
So they buy this comic book company, Valiant Comics, as well as Iguana Entertainment within the same year. And the goal was...
I feel like I'm a step ahead of you, man. I'm looking at their page right now. This looks really cool. It seems like they have all these interesting projects.
Valiant Comics?
Yeah, Valiant Universal. It seems like they built their whole world around like all of these different comic series. I mean, having never heard of a single one of these.
Are they still around?
Let me see. They don't really put... Yeah. As of 2016, they're still releasing... What they have. Unity is a series, a long-running series they have with 25 volumes. Exo Manowar came out in 2016.
I wonder who is the... If they have a parent company at this point, because I think Acclaim is gone. So they must have liquidated.
Oh, here you go. Yeah, if you want to... Yeah, it says in March 2015, Valiant signed a partnership agreement with DMG Entertainment.
Okay.
This is a nine-figure deal that they got for that.
That's so huge. They survived being bought by Acclaim. Sadly, Iguana Entertainment did not survive.
Yeah.
So Acclaim bought these two... of very different entertainment groups in Iguana and Valiant Comics, because they were this push that they were making to try to make in order to develop games themselves in house. So they bought a game development studio to do that. Mm-hmm. But then they also wanted to have these characters, these intellectual properties that they held themselves that they could then license out for other things. So, and I guess they thought that Turok was their way into that. Like, there's great recognizable characters. Yeah,
maybe they had grand ambitions, and they were like, hey, we're going to build this, you know, giant web of, the future of Brawl games will be centered around Turok.
This character from 1954.
Yeah.
That's what the kids want these days.
Uh-huh.
So, the game, Turok Dinosaur Hunter, was announced for the Ultra 64, which was, of course, the Nintendo 64 before it got a name. This game was announced in August of 1994.
Okay, yeah, well, that's a long time ago. Relative to the release of the actual console.
Development started in 1996. So, like, at the very least, a year and a half before they started making the game, they announced the game.
Uh-huh.
And if you can't tell from just my general tone how I've been talking about Acclaim, I don't have great respect for this company.
Do you think it was a sort of thing where they were like, you know, it's like they forgot about the school project, and it's like... a year before, like, oh my god, we actually have to make a game now?
I think
fuck is Turok?
They got overly ambitious with trying to become like this multimedia entertainment company. Mm-hmm. Like, hey, we have a license for Turok now, we have an in-house development studio, let's just start announcing stuff. And like, cause they probably didn't like tell the guys at Iguana, like, hey, can you make a Turok game before they announced it? Yeah. They're like, no, we're gonna make it, they're gonna do it. And they're like, oh, okay, well, we're still doing NBA Jam. We'll get on that when we're done. Mm-hmm. And I think, like, NBA Hangtime is another game that Iguana put out. Anyway.
Yeah.
So, this was actually originally planned to be nearly a launch game. They wanted it to come out sometime in September of 96,
mm-hmm.
which was the month that the Nintendo 64 came out. But, of course, it was delayed because they only started working it that same year. It reviewed quite positively,
mm-hmm.
to my surprise, and sold quite well, 1.5 million. It's in the top 45 best-selling Nintendo 64 games.
That's impressive. Yeah, I mean, it also, it's probably a lot of it, and I think of a lot of these, I noticed there's some very starry-eyed reviews on a lot of these games mm-hmm. early on, and I think probably a lot of it is that they're...
impressed with the tech.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just tech alone probably is the saving grace on a lot of this stuff, because, you know, when the graphics themselves are set aside, and then you start playing some of these games, you're like, wow, these are deeply flawed games.
Mm. So
it's how I kind of feel about some of them. But
Acclaim was so impressed with just pre-orders for this game, they announced a sequel before the game came out.
Yeah.
And again...
the seeds of evil.
The men and women who are working at Iguana Entertainment at the time, they're working hard to get this game out that's already been delayed once. They're like, hey, we're going to make a sequel. They're probably just like throwing their clipboards on the floor like, god damn it. We're not done yet.
And the turnover from the release, I mean, I don't know if you have the release date in front of you. It only came out about 18 months later.
Yeah.
A year and a half later. It's kind of an insane turnover.
This was still around the time where development cycles, you know, weren't as short as they were with the NES and the Super Nintendo, or you could roll a game out mm-hmm. within 8 or 9 months. And now you're getting into like the year plus development cycles. It's not like now where games are in development for 3, 4, 5 years before they release. But, you know, you're
or you simply release the game before it's done. Right. Say that it's an early access or whatever.
Or you're going to have a day one patch ready or a 6-month patch to add in multiplayer.
Yeah.
Anyway. Mm-hmm. But this game, and now that we're sort of moving past the objective history stuff, this game, Turok, is a train wreck.
Yes.
I am stunned this game reviewed positively. It is nearly unplayable.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so, like, your character is so unwieldy. Mm-hmm. It's so difficult to actually do anything, I feel like. The controls are unintuitive.
I mean,
the very first thing that I remember that when I, because I got a cartridge of this game. The game is super cheap.
Yeah.
When I got a
cartridge. $5 on Amazon.
Yeah, yeah. Like, the very first thing I encountered was, like, a little baby dinosaur, and it killed me.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Which is saying something.
The aiming is actually very forgiving. Yeah. As long as you're chucking something at it. Like, I think you start with, like, a bow, a knife, and just your fist. As long as you perform some sort of attack. Because all the enemies are all very fragile, too, which is a good thing because the game is so unwieldy. But as long as you're throwing something in this general direction, you'll probably kill most things.
Yeah.
The game doesn't demand very much precision. But I do have the controls pulled up on a page. I just want to go through them really quick.
Oh, because please do. Yeah.
It's so bizarre that the what they decided to do with the controller available to them. So, the A and the B buttons, what you would primarily consider like your action buttons, those scroll through your weapons in opposite directions.
Yeah, so the biggest buttons that you have, your right thumb has access to, are not used for navigational purposes with the inventory.
Right. Whereas, like, the shoulder buttons would be the more intuitive way to scroll through weaponry there. But you don't really have access to the shoulder buttons because of just the shape of the Nintendo 64 controller. Because, of course, you're moving with your analog stick, and your Z button on the back of your analog stick there is your attack. You're attacking with whatever weapon you have currently equipped. So your control pad doesn't really move your character as much as it... As I said before, it more like moves your target reticle. It's how you're aiming, which makes sense, except instead of using the D-pad for actual character movement, they're using the C buttons to do things like move forward and backward and then strafe left and right and to turn. Yeah. So you're aiming with your analog stick and moving forward just to kind of make a general turn rather than a strafe. Mm-hmm. And it is unwieldy as shit. Yeah. Like, it is really, really tough to get anything done. Like, if they had...
Well, and even the opening part, if I remember correctly, you have to, like, actually do a little bit of, dare I say, platforming, where it's, like, you have to walk across, you know, bridges.
Yeah, they have, like, these and they have, like, little coins to sort of guide your path. You do end up using one of the shoulder buttons, the right shoulder button, because that's the one you'd have access to, the way you're gripping the controller. That's jump, because of course it is. Because of course it fucking is.
Is there a key rebinding by any chance?
Not that I found, no.
Oh, okay.
Because that would be incredibly helpful, just to remap things as you see fit. But when you start the game, you're kind of thrown into, as near as I can figure, a hub world. And you're supposed to gather things in order to get you access to, like, actual levels. I never found any of them. Because I'm just wandering around, collecting things, slapping away enemies. And you find things like you find a gun, and you find arrows for your bow and arrow, and you find, like, health restores. But you're not really doing anything except sort of wander. You don't really have a map, or at least not an easily accessible one. You have no bearings on where you are or what you're supposed to be doing. You don't have a clear goal.
Yeah.
So you end up, like, wandering through this terrible-looking world with these terrible controls, fighting terrible-looking enemies who just sort of run straight at you.
Yeah. I feel like this is a game that would make an amazing trailer. It's like one of those you know, movies that you see where it's like the trailer looks awesome, where it's like they cut together this awesome thing where it's like you just mowing down all kinds of crazy dinosaurs with guns and shit.
Like the Hurricane Heist. Remember that trailer? Oh my god, dude. We gotta take this side note because I went and saw Black Panther with a couple of friends several weeks ago.
Good. Did you enjoy it?
Oh yeah, that was good. I think it could have been two really good movies. Like, there are a lot of characters,
there is a lot of plot points. There is a ton of shit going down in it, too.
Yeah, and
if anything, there's some stuff they could have jettisoned.
Sure.
I think you're right. Split it up, or maybe just cut a little bit of it.
Yeah, because, I mean, it was already, like, 2.5 hours, wasn't it? Like, if they just explore some of the, like, the finer plot points and give a few characters or like a couple extra things to do. Like, mm-hmm. there you go. You got 2 2-hour movies. Mm-hmm. Anyway.
Yeah.
And there would have been two really good 2-hour movies.
You watched the Sherlock BBC series, right? Mm-hmm. So now we literally have both Sherlock and Watson playing characters within the Marvel universe.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
I'm not saying they need to do a movie together, but I feel like there's got to be, like, a, like, fucking wink-wink at us.
That'd be amazing.
To let us know that they've got both of them.
we know what's happening here.
And it's like it's Doctor Strange, a guy who sees...
They're both playing Americans.
Hey, fair point. Wow. Didn't put that together, yeah. Well,
but yeah, it'd be good.
Anyway, you're Hurricane Heist.
Yes. So that trailer, speaking of trailers, that's why we got on this tangent.
Yeah.
That trailer, like, we were watching Black Panther, and we missed, like, the opening couple seconds of the trailer, because we were just talking amongst ourselves, and so we didn't, because, like, they sort of opened the trailer with, like, there's a storm of the century coming, and we missed that part, so we thought, like, it just looked like a movie that was starting with a heist, and then all of a sudden there's a hurricane, where the fuck did that, and that trailer plays, like a Rick and Morty sketch,
yeah,
where, like, this lady, she's guarding a vault, and then someone's coming to rob her, but there's a hurricane, and they gotta find his brother. Like, what the fuck?
By the way, hurricane...
What the fuck is this movie?
A hurricane doesn't sneak up on anybody.
No.
Hurricanes do not sneak up
they
on
They don't
you.
Surprise
Tornadoes
anybody.
Tornadoes can.
Sure.
Sure. Like, you've seen Twister.
It's a great
like,
movie.
Like, they're watching The Shining in and a tornado shows up. It's like, yeah, it totally catches them by surprise. Nobody is ever shocked by, like, a hurricane
right.
like, coming at you.
And that... I'm sure that movie bombed. Like, it had to have done terribly because I think they're also trying to like go for like the God. And I like Twister. I like stupid disaster movies.
I think Twister's a very good movie.
Yeah,
and well because it's also very real. I think that there's actually an attempt to make some interesting characters in it. I mean, not that we need to dissect the fucking film Twister. I feel like they're trying to go back to remaking dumb action movies. I think the most recent Jumanji. Did you see this trailer for Rampage that's coming out?
Yes.
And it's not just The Rock. I'm not just naming Rock movies. But it's like, I feel like they want to make intentionally dumb but fun action movies.
Now, so when I first saw the trailer to Rampage, the first couple seconds I was like, oh, are they remaking Congo? Because that would be so great with The Rock. But then it's based on a video game property, so I immediately don't care.
Yeah. You never play the Rampage game?
No.
Do you know what it's about, generally?
I think it's just about, like, destroying cities.
Yeah, pretty much.
Like Blaskor, which we'll get to.
Yeah, you have buildings, and you're one of three kaiju monsters, and you're just destroying. That's really all it amounts to. But it also seems like, in the trailer, from the bits they're showing you... And by the way, the trailer gives way too much shit. That's with all trailers. I really have grown to despise... I really don't want to watch trailers anymore, honestly.
I want teasers.
I think a teaser is good if you're... Because teasers usually basically just give you an idea of... Who's going to be in the film? Who directed it? And then they give you an abstract shot that's not from the film.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just sort of like, here's what's going on.
Yeah, and like if I see a trailer that for a movie I want to see and it's 2.5 minutes, I won't watch it.
Yeah.
Like the only time I really ever see trailers is actually when I go to a theater. And they're way too long. But I think that the last really good trailer, I think, was Annihilation. Because I think that did a really great job of showing you what the movie was without giving away what's going to happen.
Well, that movie is so unpredictable. They could have shown you clips from the very end of it, and you would have still been like, the fuck was that? It's not... No, I mean, I think... and that's my big problem is also when I watch a trailer now, I kind of do hyper-obsess over the details where I'm watching the clips, and they're all non-sequiturs, so none of this is actually being told in any true narrative. So it's like, oh, I bet you that's the end fight sequence. I bet you that's, like, when these two characters meet. I bet you that's when this happens. And I feel like I'm just predicting all of the beats in the movie by watching the trailer, which is not the idea of the trailer should be there to, like... And for starters, we should go back to putting trailers at the end of the movie, being that that's why they're called trailers, is that they happen after the film. Like, I quite frankly don't want to watch them. I would rather show up late to a movie with pre-assigned seating than sit there and watch them because, quite frankly, they do spoil so much. I kind of just want to sit there with my ears plugged and my eyes shut. If I really want to watch
because the film, hurricane heist might come on, I don't want to see it.
Not in that case, but like when I go see a movie that I know is going to be good, and then the trailers before it, I'm like, oh, I want to see all of these movies, or I feel like there's a bunch of really potentially good films here that I would like to see, and then it's like they tell me the whole thing, and I don't know. Maybe other people aren't like that. I feel like the majority of people like trailers. A lot of people like to go to the movie early just to see the trailers. And that's just, I don't know. Maybe I just overanalyze. I'm way too critical of it when I'm just sitting there watching 3 second long snips of a film. And I'm like, I now we have to know when exactly in the film this takes place. And I'm ruining it for myself. So maybe it's me, but I just,
I don't know. I think that.
And again, it's an elevator pitch film, right? Like, it's a high concept. It's a heist in a hurricane. What more do you need to know? Snakes on a plane. Like, it's telling you the plot with two words.
And I think that's what they were going for, is they wanted to, like, be this schlocky, you're going to watch it because it's bad, Sharknado type thing.
Yeah.
And I don't think they found that success.
Can we deviate a little bit into film here real quick?
Yeah.
Because somebody brought up this really, really great point, and when I read it, it really did hit true. It rung true, and it made so much sense to me, which is, like, film today is not like film when we were younger. There are no more stars. There are no more true film stars anymore. Like, and then they brought up, look at the last films by Tom Cruise, Will Smith. Bombs.
Yeah.
They did terrible. There's nobody that simply saying, or Tom Hanks. Tom Hanks hasn't had like a giant success in a long time. He's been in a lot of films, and films usually make money. But there is not a single star today that is a big enough draw that just universally people will go see.
Maybe The Rock. Maybe.
I don't think so. I think The Rock is on board with all of these really well. We'll see what happens with fucking Rampage.
Sure.
You know, there you go. I mean, I think Jumanji, you could just say it's an ensemble cast because of somebody like Jack Black probably drew a crowd.
Kevin Hart.
Kevin Hart is there too. That's another big guy. I mean, look, I just, like, if you were to go back in time 15 years and Will Smith made a movie, that was going to be the number one film at the box office for the next 3 weeks or something, you know?
Yeah.
It's just the guy was money at the box office, and no one's a guarantee anymore. People seem to care more about IP than they do about the actors in the films. I mean, people love Robert Downey Jr. as Iron Man. If Robert Downey Jr. just picked up a random property, it's not going to be successful unless people care about what's going on with that story.
Hmm.
I don't think Robert Downey Jr. himself is the draw. I think people like Tony Stark. I mean,
Where do you think that sort of thing starts? Like, can we pick like a certain point in time where we know like there's a shift happening where it's more about the property than it is about the actors or even the narrative at that point? Do you think maybe Lord of the Rings?
I think, yeah, it's hard to say what exactly
Harry Potter
is. That I think, yeah, you are seeing serialized film. I think that's part of it. You're seeing films that come out with the idea that you want to make more films on top of this.
Yeah.
Like Harry Potter or like any
of these. All the Marvel stuff, yeah.
I'm sure, we did that, I think, 3 or 4 years ago where we looked at the list of the top 10 grossing films that year. And no, I think it was even like, no, it looked like the top 15 grossing films. Only, I think, two of them were original properties.
Yeah.
Meaning that they were an original screenplay written by some person.
Yeah.
And the rest were all either sequels or established franchises or something like that, you know?
And I don't think this necessarily has to be a bad thing. Like, there is something fun about more of like a long form storytelling. Like, and it's fun that the sort of, I don't know, for the lack of a better word, biggest perpetrator of this sort of thing are comic book movies, because comic books have always been like this more long form storytelling. This is something that's going to evolve over a period of years. And you're seeing that now reflected in especially the Marvel Cinematic Universe, where part of the fun is seeing all of them to see how they connect to each other. Yeah, and they have more success doing that in their films than they do at getting people to read their comics. Yeah. Which is funny.
It is interesting. But it's like, and again, I think if there was an entire wipe of the cast in the same way that like if you had a lockout year and everybody put scrubs on the baseball field, people would not really care about that. But they could lose a Chris Hemsworth. They could recast Robert Downey. They could lose Chris Pine. They could lose anybody.
They recast Terrence Howard.
Yeah.
That was early on, but...
Yeah, well, that's an example, and we're going to see that happen very, very soon.
Yeah.
I feel like we're going to see a lot of these guys are on their last contracts. They're just like, you know... I mean, for starters, fucking Chris Hemsworth shaved his head. Mm. I think he's like, I'm done with the fucking hair. Can we cut this shit off?
Well, I think that a lot of that stuff is already being teased because of, like, Avengers... I don't know, what are we up to? Avengers 3, I think, is the one coming out, and then... Oh, no. This is like this.
I mean, we're already on our third Spider-Man.
Avengers 4, yes, true. Avengers 4 is the one coming out pretty soon, I think. I don't know. I'm getting them confused now. But, like, there's supposed to be, like, this big change, this big turnover. And people are saying, like, they're going to be killing characters off or recasting, redoing, and wiping the slate clean. Which is something that they do in comic books as well.
Yeah.
So, and, you know, Robert Downey Jr. should be playing Iron Man into his 60s.
Yeah.
Because... And that's the thing about comic books is you have like these immortal non-aging characters
mm-hmm.
who, you know, were conceived in the 1960s and who are still just 34 years old.
Yeah.
Perpetually. Anyway.
So yeah, I think people are again more into the, and again, that is such a huge draw, but I think, yeah, for the most part, and maybe directors too. Sometimes people want to see a follow-up film from a director like, Annihilation looks like it's totally my wheelhouse, but
oh, yeah.
if it weren't, but I saw Ex Machina, I would be like, I'm absolutely going to see this.
You know? Yeah, I was really interested in seeing Annihilation, and then when I realized it was the same director as Ex Machina, I was like, oh yes, I'm totally in.
Like, I don't know what he has planned for his next project, but a guy like Jordan Peele, who had such success with Get Out, I feel like whatever project he makes next will likely garner a ton of attention because people really, really like Get Out.
Yeah, I think that at some point there'll be a rebalancing of things. You know, a trend goes on for a little while and things just sort of always regress to a mean.
But yeah, think about it. Like, who out there could just simply make a film and it would be successful? I don't think there's anybody anymore.
Yeah. I don't know. We'll see.
Mm. Yeah, true. We're totally off base.
Yep. But Turok is a game based on a property.
Should there be a Turok film?
I haven't read it in the comics. Maybe they're good. Should not be a film based on this schlock.
No. What if there was a hurricane, though?
Dinosaurs in a hurricane?
Oh, well, that's kind of what happens in Jurassic. We can't really mean to get away from film.
Oh, but that's true. What happens in Jurassic that's Park. Exactly right. So. That is the plot.
Maybe.
So, what was it? We're gonna take another tangent. We're gonna fuck it. We're gonna do this.
Okay.
Des was looking at a list, and I'm trying to remember. Oh, it was a list of heroes in movies that never encounter the villain, and I forget.
Ooh, that's interesting.
I forget like the examples that was in her like little YouTube video, but I mean the first one that came to my mind was like No Country for Old Men.
Yeah.
Where the hero doesn't meet the villain, and the second one that came to my mind is like pick any lead character in Jurassic Park. Because none of them meets Dennis Nedry. He's the villain.
Yeah, you're right.
He's the guy that fucks it all up.
Yeah, that's a good point. Oh, man, I feel like this is...
The dinosaurs aren't the villains. They're just being dinosaurs. That's just...
Yeah, that's a valid point. Yeah, he is the true villain of the film that sets everything into motion.
Mm-hmm.
And the only people that interact with him are very briefly, like...
John Hammond.
Sam Jackson.
Yeah.
Has the few scenes because he's in that like computer area with him.
Yeah.
So. But yeah, that would be a cool list. I mean, I guess technically, I don't know if you could say like Usual Suspects. Because the big reveal at the end, by the time you realize who the guy even is, he's out the door. So the detective was there the whole time with the bad guy not thinking they were the bad guy.
Yeah, maybe.
I mean, I don't know if that one technically counts, but...
It's the best kind of correct. It's technically correct.
I would like to see that list. It'd be funny.
Yeah. But, and is there anything else we want to say about Turok? It's not a game you should play.
He is a Native American time-traveling warrior.
Oh, get the fuck out of here.
That's what it says here. The player assumes control of Tal Sek, or Tal Set, T-A-L apostrophe S-E-T.
So his name is
Turok.
Okay.
Yes. So there you go.
All right. And of course, you wouldn't know because the game is in first person. Unless you read the instruction manual, I suppose.
Yeah, it's a shame they don't give you, like, a mirror at any point. There's no bathroom you can go into, like, in Duke Nukem 3D.
Let's take a break. Let's take a quick break and then come back with Last Core.
Sounds good.
Core, which is a game developed by Rare, came out on March 24th, 1997. Mm-hmm. Published by Nintendo, of course. This was the second game that Rare had on the Nintendo 64. The first one was Killer Instinct Gold, which we talked about. Mm-hmm. And I think we kind of came away a little bit lukewarm. It's fine.
Yeah. I mean, it's a pretty straightforward 2D fighter. But this is far removed from that in every way possible.
Indeed. And in this game actually starts a hot streak for the developer, who, like, at this point they have 6 more games after this, and all of them are met with pretty universal acclaim. Mm-hmm. Like, they, well, with GoldenEye and Perfect Dark and Banjo-Kazooie and Banjo-Tooie and DK64 and Conker's Bad Fur Day, like, they have a bunch of games, Jet Force Gemini, they have a bunch of games that come out one after another that are very universally loved.
Well, I mean, it seems to be for at least this point in Nintendo's history, it seems like they found themselves a really good game developer, mm-hmm. and, you know, wrote them as best they could for a bunch of great titles.
Indeed. So, Chris Stamper, the founder of Rare, had this idea for a game where you go around destroying buildings. Yeah. And this idea that he had became the impetus for this Blast Corps game. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we'll get to some of the more particulars in just a second here. I don't really have too much history that I wanted to cover. Like I said before, met with pretty universal acclaim. This game didn't crack the million sales mark, though. So there's a list of about 45 Nintendo 64 games that all sold more than a million, and this one is not on it, despite being pretty well reviewed and pretty well received critically.
Well, I noticed, and quite frankly, a turnoff for me. I mean, maybe just looking at it, the cartridge, and not seeing the, of course, the Rare logo, knowing that it is a sign of quality, is just that when I was at here in Orlando at Cybertron, which is our kind of retro gaming store that I think is very, very good and worth mentioning, they've got like 6 copies. They've got tons of copies of this game, and they're selling them for like the worst conditioned ones are like $3.99. Decent condition is like $6.99.
Okay.
So this is not a really valuable game.
Yeah.
So it seems like, if anything, it got flooded. The market was flooded with it. Even though you're saying it didn't even crack a million in sales, it's like, for some reason, this was a cartridge that seemed to have stuck around and found its way into a lot of collections.
Yeah, I mean, it could be something that they printed more than they sold.
The point being, like, when I see a cartridge of Ocarina of Time is selling for like $40 or $50 bucks or whatever it is, it's like, okay, that's probably the sign of a quality game.
Yeah, whereas, you know, that one, conversely, I think cracked the 8 or 9 million sales. So,
unbelievable.
Again, probably a lot of prints out there, but it. The value that it's holding might not be a sign of rarity as it is just what people are willing to pay for it.
Yeah.
So that's why it's all holding that higher price tag. But Blast Corps, if you find it for $5, $6, $7, I think it's definitely worth a grab.
Yes. This seems to, and again, it doesn't make anyone's top lists. It makes everybody's, like, what do you call them? Honorable mentions, sure, or like hidden gems lists. People seem to have very good, I mean, and like, I'm looking at the reviews here, it's like 90% based on 12 reviews from Metacritic, which is, you know, probably about the only harvesting they can do of genuine reviews from the time frame.
Right. Yeah, not quite like the proliferation of the internet quite yet. So, you know, there are still sites out there reviewing games, but they don't have quite the same legitimacy to where they would actually be able to get review copies of games.
Yeah.
As like a print publication. Mm-hmm. And again, not too many of those out there either.
Yeah.
So the game itself, like, you watched some YouTube videos.
Oh, I'll confess, I have not played the game, but I watched a ton of videos. And I told you off air, Rare, the developers at Rare, they actually have their own YouTube channel, and they're constantly uploading really professional content about all of their games. And there's probably a good hour's worth of content of them just talking about Blast Corps.
Was there anything in particular that stuck out to you?
Again, one of those, maybe they just provide you a lot of perspective on the development of the game. And yeah, they talk about like what you're talking about, where, you know, they had a really inventive idea and how they were going to make this game play out. Some things that they think make the game hold up really well are sort of the simplicity of their control scheme.
Mm-hmm.
They like that they made an isometric, it's still fully 3D, but they had an isometric camera, so you're not sitting there juggling camera controls the whole time.
And I think it's those particular things, like, especially when you compare it to its contemporary that came out in the same month, Turok. It's that Much more limited scope. Like, they weren't going all out trying to exploit the tech as much as possible. They had this idea, and they're like, okay, let's take this idea and see how much we can expand on the idea, rather than let's try to jam as much tech into this as we can.
True.
And that's not to say it's a technically impotent game. Like,
it's a puzzle game.
Yeah.
And there's 57 levels, which is crazy. That's a lot of content. That's just the core story mode.
Mm-hmm.
There's actually other forms of playing the game. But, and that's the thing. And then, by the way, the whole premise of these levels is you basically have the equivalent of a runaway freight train,
mm-hmm.
and it's your job to clear a path for it, because it's carrying what is presumed...
like a nuclear missile or something like that.
Based on... and that's another thing that they bring up. They never explicitly state what is the biohazardous material there. It could literally be biohazard, a zombie virus they mentioned. That it could be radioactive. It could be alien, like, bodies. Like, who knows? And that was, they were joking around. They're like, it could have been anything. Like, it was just an excuse for a game mechanic.
Yeah.
Where they were like, you basically just have to ferry this thing by clearing the path.
Because what they wanted was, they wanted a game where you have to go around destroying these buildings in different ways.
And not just be maniac destroying buildings, right. But to do it for justifiable reasons.
And then they wanted you to have a time limit. They wanted there to be like, okay, see how much of this you can demolish by this certain amount of time. And rather than just having a ticking clock for you, you actually have this mechanic of the runaway vehicle getting from point A to point B. So you have to clear its path, but if you're moving a good deal faster than it, you can go around and do some other stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
There are different things, like there's a little radar tower that you can find, and there's like a, usually from what I found, one designated spot where these people are sort of like hunkered down or like trapped or something, because when you destroy the building that they're in, it will give you a message like survivors escaped. Like, oh, okay, great, the survivors escaped.
As usual, if you just destroy a building, people will survive.
Yeah. So,
well, and they also give you puzzles too. And again, where it is more of a puzzle thing, it's not just mow down everything in front of you. A lot of, like, they were showing some examples where it's like, you literally need to park your vehicle, get out, get into a crane, and then use your crane to demolish your building.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then get back in your vehicle and keep going. So it's like,
What they do early on is they introduce you to your different vehicles individually. Mm-hmm. So you get a pretty good idea of how they work. But then as you move further out the game, you'll have different mechanics, like getting into a crane, or you'll have multiple vehicles in one level, and what you want to do is get out of vehicles and move around to get into a different vehicle that will accomplish a different thing. So,
and when it goes from like being just a traditional dump truck to being like the thing with the smasher arms to being like literal mecha things.
That like fires, they have like a little motorcycle mecha thing that fires missiles.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, and one of my favorite things, you mentioned the one that has like the hammer arms on either side, and what that does is as you're moving forward, it pounds out to the side so you can destroy like a row of buildings. Like if you're driving down the road and there's rows of buildings on either side, you can destroy them all by driving through. And that one has a sort of a fuel economy to it. So you'll have a certain amount of actions you can perform. You can ram into buildings a certain amount of times with those arms before you have to find a refuel crate and pick it up. And early on, they have them in your path, so as to more teach you how to use the vehicle rather than worry about the sort of fuel or ammunition.
Does fuel show up as an icon on the mini-map?
For that...
They gave you that little mini-map, which is kind of useful.
The mini-map, I haven't quite mastered, because what it will do is you pause to look at the map, and that will show you where your runaway... Your escort, like what you're trying to get from point A to point B, will show you what this, and you can sort of scroll along its intended path. Mm-hmm. So you can kind of look ahead to see what sort of buildings you're going to need to destroy, you know, three, four screens up the road.
Mm-hmm.
But to my knowledge, no. What they will do is they'll show you like those pickup crates if it's along that path. Mm-hmm. But I have not found a way to just scroll around the map in general.
Okay.
So, but one of the other things that they do is that there's another vehicle that's just pretty much like this mecha thing that has a jetpack, and you fly up really high, and you position yourself over the top of a giant building, and you slam down into it and smash it into the ground.
I like that.
So you could potentially have a mission where you have to clear a path of buildings that are low to the ground, and it's more effective to use the thing that's hammering out the sides of them. and then you have to jump out because there's a tall building in the way and get inside a mech and slam down on top of it and then switch back to your other vehicle. And yeah, so there's a lot of potential for swapping out and demolishing buildings in different ways. Mm-hmm. So there's also the one mechanic that I really despised, couldn't stand when I had to play missions with this thing, is there's this dump truck looking thing. And the basic idea around this dump truck is that you have to drift its back end into a building to demolish them. So you have to go toward a building, turn and drift away from the building, but so much so that you're ramming your backside into it. And it is just aggravating
it came up in their videos where they were like, it was the creator's idea. He really wanted to do this. And watching him do it, because they actually showed some video of him doing it, it's like, okay, he just knows what to do. Because it's not even like he's drifting. He's literally just basically got it going sideways, driving it around like it's this new form of transportation, like this new kind of vehicle in its own way. Like, it's very bizarre watching him doing it. He makes it seem so easy.
Yeah.
But I feel like if I was just being told to do it, I would be like, fuck this.
Yeah, that's one of the things about... When you're designing a level, you run into in Mario Maker. When I would build a Mario Maker level, I would build the level just based around how I perform jumps. So I would build a basic level layout and this is how I'm going to run through it. Yeah. And I would place obstacles accordingly. Mm-hmm. So no matter how many times I would play through it, I had a really good success rate because it's just based on the way I play. Because
you're starting from a point where you already knew how to do it, and you're just making it a little more complex with each turn.
Right. And you were like... And then that's why playtesting is so important, because as they were building the game, even the people who were making the game outside of the lead designer found this mechanic so annoying that they didn't want it in there. And he was like, no, it's staying in. We're doing this. Ugh. Should have been cut.
Did you ever play any of my ghost houses that I made in Mario Maker?
Yeah.
Man, because that was all about just asshole puzzle after asshole puzzle.
Sure were.
Oh, man, those are so funny. I just remember making them, and I was like, this is going to be obnoxious. I think you would get past the one thing and be like, okay, so maybe we're rounding it. And it's like, no, you've just done a tenth of the level. Mm. It's like, and I was also playing other people's games, and if I saw that they did something interesting, I'm like, I'm stealing that idea. Mm. And then I would just make these most complex, obnoxious maps possible, where it's like, you got to figure out weird minutiae of every little item in the game.
I think it's one of the really, really great things that came out of Mario Maker was that people would use these Mario mechanics to make these, these puzzles and trap rooms and things that you don't really see in Mario games, where you just have to figure out how to get through an area rather than having these platforming feats that you have to perform.
True.
Which was
That's a tricky balance. It's a tricky balance because I feel like that's what Mario is. Hand in hand about it is truly about precision platforming, but then it's also about puzzles. Mm. So where do you find that healthy balance?
My favorite things was always just to make a level where you got 30 seconds on the clock, run as fast as you can, get there.
My favorite gag that I came up with was putting you in a two brick. You come through a door, and then you're on a stack of those things where you sit on them and they start to shake and And on both sides, you are basically trapped with walls of bricks and then booze everywhere. So you have to spam back and forth, looking both ways to prevent them from coming at you. And I made it so that basically, unless you are frantically doing it the second you enter the room, if you slip up at all, you're dead. Because of the time it took you to descend to the bottom.
Ah, that's evil.
And I was like, why did I do that? That was so mean. It's like... And it's, again, because I discovered somebody did something similar, and I was like, that's clever.
Hmm.
That's annoying, but clever.
Let's be a dick.
I put a door over death. Or putting a door over a thing with no floor.
Yeah.
Where you would fall to your death.
Yeah, kind of inch your way out, pixel by pixel.
Exactly. It's like, that's really obnoxious. Or, again, hidden block tricks, just putting somebody in a room with a pipe going in and a pipe going out, and one glowing gold question box, and then there's an entire row of invisible blocks beneath it that just spawn the guys that shoot spells at you.
Oh, god damn it.
Even when you jump to try to escape them, you're creating more. what a terrible person I am.
That's the fucking worst.
No, we don't need to talk more about it. Yeah, it's I don't know, it's fun.
Blastcore. Yeah, I don't know if
let's get back on track.
Blastcore. Yeah, I don't know if I've too much else to say about it. Like you mentioned before, the controls are much more simplified.
Yeah.
It's like this is how you move. This is your accelerate. This is your brake. And it actually does remind me of a bit of the mechanics in another Rare game. Ooh, this might not have been Rare. This might have been a company formerly before they became Blizzard. Rock and Roll Racing.
Rock and Roll Racing.
I believe that was Blizzard before they became Blizzard.
Mm-hmm.
RC Pro-Am, I think, is the Rare game that I'm thinking of. But either way, both games, it's a little bit like tank controls, but not purely tank controls, because you have your accelerate and your brake, and you're always going to be moving forward, and you're controlling your turn mm-hmm. with the analog stick.
Yeah.
So it's not quite like Resident Evil style tank controls, but it's similar. You do have like this world map that you go onto. You can get different accolades on levels by completing it in a certain amount of time. So you get different accolades. Like it'll keep track of like how many buildings you've demolished in a level. You can replay levels.
The tens of millions of dollars of damage you've done.
Yeah, there's like this economy where you destroy a building and it puts like $40,000. I guess that's like your score.
I took it as being this is the monetary damage you've inflicted.
Could be.
Because not that they're trying to stop you from doing it. I think you want to rack it up. And it's like, look at how much fucking damage I did.
Because it must be like...
you destroy a building and it says 400 grand or $40,000 or whatever, you know?
It's got to be something like that because I haven't found a use. And I think it does keep track of your total amount of currency that you've either racked up or destroyed, the value of the things you've destroyed. But I can't find a use for that. I don't know if, like, it doesn't seem like there's any sort of, like, upgrade shop or a place where you can buy more vehicles or anything like that. So, I don't know. It must just
Maybe it is like a prestige thing.
Yeah.
I saw that there actually are racing levels in it.
I've not encountered any.
They're, like, a special feature in the game. Because they said that they also modeled them after real life racetracks.
Okay.
Parts of them are supposed to be modeled after real racetracks, which I thought was kind of funny.
Hmm.
So yeah.
I haven't seen any of those yet. I'm not super in depth in the game. I've maybe done maybe 20 levels at most. And this game, like you said before, 57 levels, it's got a ton in there.
Yeah.
Probably.
But it sounds like they play pretty quick.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the most I've spent in a level is maybe 5 or 6 minutes.
The YouTube sort of like N64 guy, there's this guy that basically has just reviewed hundreds of N64 games. I've watched some of his other videos before, and a lot of it is just sort of like, you know, he talks about the clunky nature of some of the games, and he very rarely do you ever see this guy go kind of glow about a game. And he really deeply loved Blastcore.
Hmm.
Thought it was really a fun game, and one that not only holds up well, but it's sort of like it had a novel idea and they didn't go crazy with everything. It's just really simple. Again, high concept. You get in a fucking truck and you just destroy stuff. It's kind of fun.
Yeah, and I would agree. Like, this game does hold up pretty well.
Oh, and he said that, and that's what the other thing about it. He's like 57 levels sounds like a lot. I remember when I got the cartridge, I beat it that weekend.
Mm.
So he was like... And granted, that is probably, churning through a couple of liters of Mountain Dew.
Yeah.
But, you know, it tells you, I mean, yeah, it's the worst shit ever. My God. It tells you that the game is designed to be these little quick blasts of gaming. They're not supposed to be these you know, kind of like grand, massive levels that take forever to beat. And maybe that's one up that this thing has on frickin' Turok. They're not trying to weave some grand story. They're putting you in a big robot suit and telling you to destroy some buildings.
Yeah. I think this game has a lot of things up on Turok.
Yeah, true.
Like, I don't know. Like, this is... if we were to construct, like, a ranking... And then maybe we should. Maybe we should have a running ranking of our N64 games. That would be kind of fun. But, this game would be... I think would rank relatively high if, like, we're just doing, like, an impromptu one.
Yeah.
Like, probably right behind Mario 64.
Yeah. There you go.
Because...
That's a good sign.
And this, like, just like Mario 64, this game actually has a lot to do. Whereas, you know, we have games, we've talked about games like Wave Race and Pilot Wings,
mm-hmm.
where Wave Race is, you know, you got a few Grand Prix in there, but not a whole lot of depth to it unless you really like racing.
I wasn't crazy about it because, again, the controls were...
Mm-hmm.
And again, not to say everything's about controls. I think I just didn't get the physics of the game. I was having a terrible time using accurate water propulsion.
Yeah.
Because that's
a problem. There are times where the track itself is fighting you.
Yeah. Compared to Pilot Wings, like, I had a blast on Pilot Wings. I thought it was really, really fun. And I thought it was the shape of what's to come when I played it. I was like, okay, you've shown me some really, really fun stuff. I certainly think that this console and graphics are going to mesh well and it's going to make sense.
Yeah.
In other games. And Pilot Wings was fine on its own, but, you know.
Okay, I'm grabbing the list.
Oh, yeah? What's up? The list so far.
Yeah, so the list so far of games that we've talked about for N64.
Yeah.
Mario 64, Pilot Wings 64, Wave Race 64.
Mm-hmm.
Killer Instinct Gold, Mario Kart, Blast Corps, and Turok. What was it, seven? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Yeah.
I think only one truly would say I am better than Blast Corps. And that's probably Mario 64, right?
Yeah.
We haven't hit the things that make this console amazing. Like, you know, people love GoldenEye. You get a pair of Zelda games.
Star Fox. But we're getting to Star Fox pretty soon. And we're kind of wrapping up our thoughts on the current stuff right now. One thing that we have not talked about yet this month, we're not going to talk about this show, but Doom 64 came out on March 31st.
Oh, shit.
So we'll get to that next month.
Sweet. Yeah. Very cool. Like, I mean, I love id Software, you know, Doom, Quake. I love that Hexen came out on this console.
Oh, yeah.
Hexen, that'll be so much fun.
Hexen actually isn't too far behind. Hexen's May of 97, yeah.
Holy shit. All right, well, I gotta get on that, man.
Doom 64 in March of 97, then Hexen in May of 97. So, okay. Next couple months, we'll have some shooters to talk about.
Yeah.
Hopefully quite a bit more competent than Turok.
Yes.
I would have to imagine.
We can only hope.
So, you mentioned off-air that you had one more retro thing you wanted to bring up.
I did, yeah. So, you know when we did our mini-show, and I was like, I haven't played a single game.
Yeah.
I have played a game, and I played a lot of it lately, just because I was thinking to myself where I was like, I don't want to get involved in a big, complex RPG.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't want to get into time-sync first-person shooters. I don't want to do MOBA games. And I was like, I want to play something fun and simple. And I caged the thought to talk about it then because I want to talk about it here. I feel like it's the better podcast to do it on. I have been playing a ton of Super Mario Brothers 3.
Oh, nice.
And I kind of want to talk about it. I don't know if we've ever really talked about Super Mario Brothers 3.
No, I think the only
opportunity... We've talked about All-Stars, probably.
Right.
It's a part of All-Stars, but that's not fair to the game, mm-hmm. I don't think. So,
have you been playing it... The NES version, or are you playing like the All-Stars version?
I am playing the original version by way of my DS.
Oh, nice.
It is a $4.99 game.
Yes.
On the Virtual Console, and it is worth every penny and then some, I tell you. It's
wonderful. So good.
I've beaten the game 3 times in a row.
Oh, shit.
And now I am doing a kind of a fuck you exploit save state mode.
Okay.
And I'll show you what I've been up to. By the way, I discovered by doing it... that there is actually a great way to just get max lives very, very quickly.
Yeah.
There is this one fortress. By the way, I got a whole breakdown here planned. We'll get into it. There's this one fortress where it's sort of like there's a hidden P-switch, and the P-switch sort of turns the entire stage into coins.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there's a very, very... It's one of the few ones where there's a very limited time frame for the stage. But still, you can easily rack up about maybe 5 to 10 lives before you die. And then you just do it again.
Right.
So it's kind of sort of a way to get infinite lives really, really quickly. Sort of in the same way that you would exploit the Dark Forest. I also learned that your inventory row maxes at 4.
Yes.
You can only get 4 inventory rows, which is
kind of... burn the useless ones quick.
Yeah. I stopped on the 8th world because I really want to just milk it. But if you want to see what's going on here...
I don't want to mess up.
Look at my inventory, man. I'll tell you.
What button flips? Okay, found it.
Okay, yeah. So.
Had a frog suit.
Yeah, I got multiple frog suits, multiple hammer bros.
Puke clouds.
Three or four peelings.
Oh, nice. You got multiple Hammer Bros. That's awesome.
Yeah, yeah. So this was, again, exploiting save states. And when that card game comes up, just, you know, get it. Oh, did you see how many lives I have?
Oh, no, I didn't bother looking. 86.
You think that's enough? You think that's enough to
Yeah, I think that'll get you there. I think World get, 8. One of the really great things, and again, like this might be a fun one just to exploit save states with. One of the really fun things to do is actually go up against Bowser with the Hammerhead Brother suit. He dies in two hammers.
Yeah.
He is such a pushover to those hammers.
So, and I learned some interesting things about that. Okay, maybe we should just... Can I,
I got
a fucking spreadsheet here, man. So, my opening thought is that it is a truer sequel to Mario Bros. And the perfect predecessor to what would become Super Mario
Bros. Oh, certainly. World. Certainly.
I think, you know, people always talk about, like... Or like Doki Doki Panic or whatever it is. So
just in case anyone, like I can't imagine you'd find our little podcast on the internet without knowing this. Mario Brothers 2 in the United States was a sort of Mario reskin of a game called Doki Doki Panic in Japan, which was a game, Retronauts did a really great podcast covering the history of this, but it was a game created based on this property in Japan. And Mario Brothers 2 in Japan is what we know as Lost Levels in the US, where they just took Mario Brothers 1 and made some really mean levels in there and called that Mario Brothers 2.
Yeah.
We did eventually see that in the US in Mario All-Stars.
Which is great, by the way. It's a fun game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And
tough, but fun.
And Mario Brothers 2, Doki Doki Panic, are the US version of that with the Mario characters, did also eventually come out in Japan as Super Mario USA.
Yeah. What must they think of us? Man. Oh, but, and that is one that is 100% about puzzles and pretty much zero about platforming. Yeah. I mean, I shouldn't say that. 90% puzzles, 10% platforming.
But the first true sort of evolution of the Mario series comes in Super Mario Brothers 3, which I think came out in like 89 in Japan, not till 91 in North America. Yeah.
So, feel of the control of your character, really, really loose. If anything, the game feels like it's on ice. And there are ice levels, which are even worse. Like, it is the controls are not the precision platforming that you get from Super Mario World, or from Super Mario Brothers. And not even really in Super Mario World either. It's also, there's a lot of precision platforming that's expected of you in both those games that this game, frankly, doesn't demand of you, thankfully, because it is so loose. Everything feels so loose. The levels are also, in my opinion, way shorter.
They are very short, levels,
I mean, granted, your average world might have 12, 13, like, just straight-up world.
Yeah,
like straight-up levels
when, once you get, once you get, like, past World 3, well, even World 3 has a ton of levels. Once you get, like, God, World 2, I think, even has, like, 8 or 9 individual levels in it.
But, I mean, but again, a lot of these are very, very short. Yeah. A third the length of what you would expect from probably a Super Mario Brothers.
I hadn't played Super Mario Brothers 3 in quite some time. And about a year and a half back, I turned it on. And I was stunned to... Because World 1-1 is exactly the way I remember it in Mario Bros. 3. Except it just never registered in my brain how brief a level it was. You're done with it in 20 seconds.
Yeah, and again, the game is that there are more puzzles.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like the game is loaded with little sneaky puzzles that are everywhere. You just maybe aren't aware of them. And in the past, when I played the game, I played it kind of just to beat it.
Yeah.
You know, where it's like, if there's a branching path and it has a stage 2 and a stage 3, I beat stage 2 and I move on to stage 4. I don't sit there and complete everything. And You kind of miss things that are there, where you have this rotating inventory of items that, if you're exploiting them correctly, unlocks all kinds of crazy things. And even if it's just like a P-switch that gives you 20 coins, it's very cleverly hidden.
Yeah.
Very sneaky.
Yeah, really, really packed with secrets and stuff.
Yeah. So we still have a timer. The game seems to require you to have a timer, which... I mean, I guess there is a purpose for it and all that. Some levels, I kind of wish they just simply didn't have a timer, so I could explore. So I could keep looking, because I feel like, again, I'll frequently find myself just getting through a level, and I'm like, oh, timer just went off. I got 100 seconds. I got to get out of here.
Because this was the first, maybe not like the exact first, because Doki Doki Panic, but it was like the first proper Mario game where you could scroll backwards. You could actually go back and look at things.
Oh, that is great, too. The ability to refresh items helps mm-hmm. tremendously
yeah.
in this game.
Yeah.
An item inventory, which is great. I think maybe that Super Mario World made a better take on it, I guess, and just simply giving you an extra item. And they also limit the number of items you can potentially have. There's actually about 3 core items in Super Mario World. And this one, there are many.
Oh, yeah.
It is a bullet point I have. We will talk about this.
So many just... And some items you can get in one place. Like, there's one place you can get a Hammerhead Broker suit. Although you had two. Where's that other one that you found?
Gambling. Let's talk about that. This is a fucking beautiful place to start. The fact that we have maps. We actually now have, in the same way that we've become so accustomed to Super Mario World having a map, we now have each of these individual maps, which not only just have a path for you to go down with tunnels and stuff like that, with pipes to travel around, but you get the levels you have to beat to move on, and they block you. You have random encounters that can be traveling around. Usually it's hammer dudes or all over the map. You've got puzzles that pop up. You have puzzle houses. You have gift houses.
Mm-hmm.
You've got fortresses. And then you've got the final fucking castle.
You got the magical ship that will appear every once in a while. They just collect coins.
Oh, it's wonderful. Yeah. All of this neat stuff happens. And where am I getting my hammer, bros? Cheating with save states. And by the way, it doesn't matter the point at which you pick it. It's random. When you're in the Toad house with the 3 boxes.
Right.
Just pick any one of them. You can have your save state with your character right on top of the box. It will be completely random every time you open it.
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing that I can tell is that certain worlds have better spawn rates for certain items.
There's one Toad house in World 6, the Ice World, where you have to beat this particular level that actually has a really crazy method in which you beat it. You have to like exit the level through the top. But... There's a Toad House right behind it, and the success rate for getting Hammerhead Brothers suits there is very high.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I can't remember the last time I went to that Toad House and didn't get a Hammerhead Brothers suit.
Yep. I mean, that's what I did with these, is I would play it a few times, and if I found, like, if I opened one up and it was a fire flower, I was like, whatever.
Mm.
I would move on. If I opened it again and I got a P-Wing, I'd be like, okay, P-Wing's pretty good.
Yeah.
And then once I got to World 6, like you're saying, that's when I was expecting... the best possible gear.
Mm.
So, we were going.
But to... like, even if you get like a mushroom as your backup item, like that's still like you get to enter a stage with a mushroom. Like you never feel guilty about using it. Like there are some items you like to hoard.
Yeah,
true. You don't want to like just blow a P-Wing, just on any random stage. You want to save those for later. But like a mushroom, a firefly, you got no problem. Like, yeah, let's just use this.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And those are the items. So mushroom. And I have written here, the only thing more synonymous with Mario than Mario himself is the mushroom. Mm-hmm. I feel like it is more important than Luigi is the mushroom. It is quintessential to
your
gaming experience. Yeah, totally.
And until, I guess, you get to... With 2D Mario, for certain.
Yeah.
Until you get to, like, when you get to 3D Mario, you don't really have a whole lot of mushrooms anymore. Unless they're one-up mushrooms.
Yeah. You've got the Fire Flower,
mm-hmm.
Which is, of course, the core staple. And a lot of what I'm listing this here... I am excluding Mario 2. I'm just sort of pretending it doesn't exist.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of this as the true sequel to the original Mario. So, of course, you have to have the Fire Flower. And you know what they did? They kind of fucked it up. You glow red. You don't get your awesome red outfit. You just glow red.
The color palette is like an orange and red.
And maybe that's because I'm thinking of like All Stars, where it's like they actually change your outfit to be red and white, as opposed to simply just like glowing it.
Yeah.
Kind of unimpressive. Doesn't look that cool.
Well, the color palette in Mario 3 is a little funny because
it's all very muted.
Yeah, like, yeah. And
Super Mario World bursts with color.
Like, and he's wearing like black overalls and a red shirt, whereas his overalls have changed quite a bit over time. Like in Mario 1, he's wearing brown overalls and a red shirt. Then when he gets a Fire Flower, he changes into white overalls and an orange shirt.
Yeah. Now he's got this fucker Cappy. who needed this guy? Yeah. But anyway, the Fire Flower is virtually unchanged. It is the exact same thing, man.
Yep.
They nailed it the first time. Two shots at once, and that's it.
Yep.
One of the things I noticed is that the game actually kind of expects you to get the idea that you fire a ball at a target you are currently jumping directly at, which is scary. Scary as a player to actually be expecting to hit the thing.
Really fun to execute, though.
But like, it feels good when you get it right.
It feels, yeah, it feels great to just blast through a level with a firefly and just shoot everything in your way. I mean, everyone get the fuck out of here.
Yeah. Oh, okay, so you get the wing, mm-hmm. which is sort of the precursor to the cape.
Maybe the cape
is a better item in general.
But... represented by a leaf.
Yes.
And turns them into a raccoon. Mm-hmm. But then there's also the pea wing. Which is a different... yeah. Mm-hmm. Because you have the meter. You have the pea meter that builds up, and when it builds up all the way by your run.
Unneededly specific thing. I kind of just like it when Mario just starts running and then jogging, and then his arms go out. And I'm like, I know I'm at maximum speed. Now they actually have this thing that lets off that noise.
That ringing. I don't know. I can understand why they did it. I think by the time you get to Mario World... they do express it better by just like you have speed and you jump, and like if you jump with a cape, like, oh my god, what's happening? And you get that a little bit in Mario 3, like the first stage, you have like the coins that lead you up into like this cloud where you can grab a one up.
Yep.
And if you're running and you got that raccoon suit, all of a sudden you're like you're off the ground and you're flying, and your only indication that you could do that is the ringing. I don't know, I guess the P meter comes in handy if you are working with a really limited space. It gives you this audio cue, like, I can go now.
It sticks around in the overworld, which I find funny, too, because they didn't want to make it cut. This bar never changes. This bar is with you no matter what the fuck is happening right here.
Right.
You're always out here, like, lower screen, like, telling you what's going on.
The whole game is framed
by
this bar, and then also, like, some letterboxing going on.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so it's interesting that they want to be a little more specific about that and how you can sustain that, like, top speed.
Mm-hmm.
But also, it's, you know, it's pretty clear. I think you just need the audio cue to know you're going that fast. What else we got? Frog suit. Oh, man, I actually love the frog suit. Having played this a bunch now, it might be my favorite item.
Oh, yeah? Okay.
It makes me, and I've never said this about any other Mario game, it makes me love water levels. Fucking wonderful being in that frog suit. You feel so good.
Yeah, is there
cruising through levels, and there's every water level. The game doesn't actually have that much water.
Mm-hmm.
There is like a whole area with water. Yeah, sure. But like when they give you a water level, they're giving you so much stuff to explore, and it's all sneaky. Like for the sheer fact that, like, you know, when there's those burst jet pipes that kind of can push you down or push you up, that doesn't affect your frog suit at all.
Right.
You have no kiting, I guess you would call it, or whatever, when you're swimming around, gone. You just swim at max speed.
Mm-hmm.
In any direction you want.
It's the only way to play water levels in Mario games is to have a frog suit.
Yeah.
Get that full directional control.
And as kind of a joke, it's fun to play them in land levels. and even then, they're actually still pretty useful. They actually have crazy range on jumps. They make a lot of platforming in the game. When the game doesn't demand a lot of platforming, but when it does... the frog suit's actually a huge help because also it doesn't drift very much, I've noticed. You kind of hop and land. That's it. Mm. Like, there's no, like, that, none of that, like, again, I feel like this game is kind of on skates. Like, if you just jump with your Mario, you land, and then you kind of just waddle forward a little bit with your big fat self. Like, with the frog suit, it's up and down. If there was ever a point where it was a long-winded, and there's actually a couple of I'm in World 8 right now, there's actually a couple of chips that are like that, where it's very demanding, kind of precise jumping that you have to do. Frog suit is perfect for it. Oh, and as with all of these items, you are one hit away from losing it, so don't get too attached to anything you have.
Something that this game does do is that in Super Mario Brothers 1, this game's direct predecessor, if you have a fire flower and you get hit by an enemy, you're back down to small. You start back at zero. Whereas this game, you actually go through the process of, like, okay,
that's nice.
You got your fire flower, you got hit, okay, you're just big Mario.
Yeah.
So it does give you that little extra HP, I suppose.
And the game is also, through the course of the game, generous with giving you items.
Yeah.
It gives you lots and lots of items. Mm-hmm. So you're never going to be lacking at least the fundamental stuff unless you are really, really getting hit all the time. You're going to be big, at least, and you'll probably even have either the tail or fire flowers.
Mm-hmm.
Next item I have, I've got three more items to go, actually. You have the boot, which is really rare. There's only a couple of stages.
One level.
Or is it just the one?
Just the one.
One level. Yeah, that's the only boot you get. It's not an item, I don't think, either. So
it's this totally, like, throwaway little thing that they had in the game where... it's a really fun power-up because it pretty much gives you, like, this locomotion invincibility. You can walk on anything. You're...
Given the volume of levels in the game, I feel like they could have had one more tease with the boot. It would have been fun.
It'd been really cool to like go through like a World 8 level with a lot of lava or just walking over it in your boot.
I was going to say, I want, you know how there's the big worlds and little worlds? Mm-hmm. I want one where I'm big and everything's little and I have my boot. And I'm just squishing. Just crushing all the baddies. That would be so fun. The Tanuki suit, which is probably the most popular item.
Probably.
I think it's cool. It's really cool. I don't think it's all that useful. I think one of the funnest things to do is actually when you're kind of in the air flying, you just turn on your Tanuki suit and then just drop like a rock.
That's how you eliminate your traction problem.
I find that it rarely actually genuinely saves me.
What's the other point of it? Like, you turn into a statue and let a dry bones walk right by you. Like, why don't you just jump on it?
Yeah, but you know, it's cool. Again, a really, really cool idea. Yeah. I feel like it's maybe missing something to really push it over the top, but I can see why people like it. You're in a bear suit. You're adorable. It's fucking Mario.
This was a game where they had just a ton of ideas, and they could do them all, so they did them.
Mm-hmm. And lastly, and bestly, hammer suit.
Oh, yeah.
Hammer suit. Even if the effect is not that great, and like you said, it's great for killing Bowser. Even if the effect isn't that great, you look so cool. It is so much fun being a hammer bro. It is just great playing through any stage as the hammer bro.
It is really, really fun. Like, it is definitely my favorite suit in that game because, like anything, you can kill anything.
Yeah.
And in that suit.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's great. And again, cute design. Like, by the way, all of these, aside from the actual Fire Flower itself, which doesn't just do anything but change your palette to red, the designs look really cool. You look neat in all of your different suits. You actually hunch down in your frog suit, you know. You've got your helmet and your crazy backpack with the hammer suit. You know, you're in a big bear suit or whatever.
Bag full of hammers.
Yeah, it's fun. Okay, as for levels, like, I already talked about the water levels. I think they're great. I think this is actually easily the best use of water in any of these platforming Mario games. Mm. Really, really good use of it. The oversized everything stage is so
the giant
fun.
World. Yeah, yeah.
I remember when I was a kid first saying that, and I was like, how did this not ever happen before? Like, why isn't this always a thing? You know?
Why isn't everyone gigantic?
Yeah, like, this seems like this should be absolutely essential.
I loved when you could you sort of like make your own, going back to Mario Maker, you could make your own giant world just by feeding things mushrooms while you're designing.
Oh, isn't that cool?
Yeah. And actually I had a stage that I was really proud of. It was not like a stage rate 30 seconds. It was a stage where basically, like, if you put doors, you're basically like making two different levels. And I made a level like in Mario 3 where you flip back and forth between giant world and like where things were gigantic and things were regular size. And I did the same thing in Mario Maker, basically by making two identical stages, except in one of them I fed all the enemies mushrooms.
I like that. It's pretty cool. Well, and yeah, that's literally what Mario... So there's a level like that in Super Mario 3, where all you do when you go in and out of the doors is change the size of the items.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that it aids you in unlock... It's what, again, as with so many of these levels, you can blast right through the whole thing, ignore every door, and go straight to the end, tag your star, and you're done. But if you want to sit there and puzzle it, if you want to sit there and puzzle the game, like, most of the levels seem to actually want you to do that. In spite of the fact that they give you a timer, which they should not do for these fun puzzle levels, I think. Okay, fortresses. Yeah, fortresses.
And you know, to your point, once you beat a level, you can't go back in. It's like Mario World where you go back in, like, okay, well, let's find the P-switch in this one.
Oh, they absolutely need, like, re-entry on these.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that was their thought, is their concern was that people are going to use this as a cheap opportunity to stock up on items, which you could do.
Yeah, maybe.
Unless you prevented start selecting. I mean, if start select wasn't a feature in the game, then, you know, you would, if forcing somebody to play through a game. But then you would probably find that it's like, oh, this stage is perfect for getting a quick flower.
Yeah, but they didn't have, like, a problem doing that in Mario World. Like, it's just like, enter the stage, grab your cape, leave.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Anyway, so fortresses are a thing now, and they're not the castles, the fortresses.
Right.
You know, so more opportunities for just puzzles. No, very little platforming on any of these levels. They're all puzzles.
It's all the same boss.
Yeah. I was going to get into that later. That's the one big drawback on this game. And they're kind of like ghost houses. So, you know. And like you're saying, the bosses at the end of them, so repetitive.
Mm-hmm.
Why even have them? You know?
It's a problem that of platformers in general that doesn't really ever get totally solved until like probably nearly a decade or two decades later, where you have a game that's all about platforming and running and jumping, and then you have bosses where you're just in this confined area and just jump on his head three times. It doesn't really have anything to do with...
Maybe the Super Mario World Bowser is the best boss they've had up until that point.
Maybe.
Because, seriously, we're talking about Reznors. You know? We're talking about fucking Reznors, or we're talking about timing jumps on top of the same thing. And where literally the only thing that's changing, really, that I've noticed at all is maybe they move a little faster and the blocks change above you.
Yeah.
And it's not like it's that hard. No. Just kind of like, gotta...
And once you get
the timing... Bring him into the area and then you're... I mean, you just time it so that you hit them the second that they are ready to be hit.
Yeah.
And then you're golden. Like,
yep. These things are not challenging. And maybe they weren't, I don't know, maybe they weren't meant to be. It's also just as likely that maybe they just didn't have an idea of what they should be doing. Mm-hmm. But these fortresses work when you have to continue. Like, if you run out of lives, you game over, you can continue. What happens is all of the levels reset, except the fortress... When you beat the fortress, it just demolishes this locked door that's on the map screen.
Yes.
And that affords you a shortcut so that if you game over, you don't have to replay all of the levels, just maybe a few of them.
Yeah. Oh, did I spell that out? That's what I'm doing with this current run through. I am beating and unlocking everything.
Nice.
I mean, I'm not finding every single little secret hidden in every level.
Just beating all the levels.
I'm making sure that everything that can be beat is beaten. Every single game that can be played has been played.
Nice.
That's it. What else we got? Oh, the castles themselves. The castles are surprisingly faithful. I guess the castles would be the fortresses. There's some that are not really the flying ships. So some of the castles actually resemble the Super Mario Brothers castles, the final stages of them. You know, where it's the same music. It's the same, same silver blockage with red mm-hmm. lava beneath you. Just really... feels like the old school games, and it abandons that overworld color palette where everything's kind of murky, you know, and it just goes straight to those bright reds, bright silver, and your character.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, and sorry, to your point, you have the flying levels, which are, I hate to say it, auto-scrollers.
They sure are.
But they're still fun. I think they're still pretty fun.
Yeah. Well, what I like about them is when you get into those bullet hells.
Yeah.
Where you have those panic moments where you're sliding and ducking and trying to jump on top of things. Yeah.
And
it gets frantic. And I think that because of they're auto-scrolling, it gets even more frantic. Because you can't really escape. You're trapped in there and you have to move at the level speed.
Yeah. And you'll also find that where it's the sort of thing where you're used to your body stopping the event happening, mm-hmm. if that makes sense. Where it's like the piranha plant's going to come out, but if you're next to the pipe, it's not going to.
Right.
The cannons are, if you're standing in front of that cannon, it's going to burst right in your face. Enjoy that, you know? They want it, like you're saying, they want it to be that bullet hell. Mm-hmm. They want those little gopher dudes throwing wrenches at
assholes,
you.
Yeah.
They want the bullets going this way.
Are deadlier than the bullets. They throw the wrenches, and you can't jump on top of the wrenches.
Yeah, you gotta take those guys down, mm-hmm. like the second that they're there. And even then, they come back. They're not gone, and that's it. They actually come back, which is so fucking annoying. And you'll also notice that when the camera wants to, because that's how physics works apparently, when the camera moves up and down, so does the projectile. It kind of tracks with it. So if you think that you're ducking safely, and then all the camera has to do is just start turning downward, and then the trajectory
of grazes the
wrench
the top of your hat,
hits you, and it's like, oh, well, thanks, game. Well, fuck you, man. Ugh. Ice stages. I wrote a thing about ice stages. Like, your character is already so slippery. I hate these ice stages so much. I just don't like them. I think that they need to tighten up the controls before they even start dealing with that. I'm going to get through the rest of this pretty quick here, I think. So, the bad guys. You get, again, a lot of old school stuff. You get the Koopas, a bunch of different types of Koopas.
Mm-hmm.
I think the other thing I noticed is that the green shells means that they will walk off cliffs. Red shells means they stay on the track.
Right. Yeah, and that's been in Mario since Mario 1.
Yeah, so...
that's how Koopa behave.
You've got flying Koopas, you've got the dry bones, mm-hmm.
You've got flying Goombas.
Yeah, yeah,
you've got flying Goombas that will shit out little mini Goombas that prevent you from jumping. Ooh,
those guys suck.
Yep. Yeah. You got Hammerhead Brothers, you got Boomerang Brothers, you got Fireball Brothers.
Sledge Brothers, yeah. Uh-huh. You got Bub Bombs. You got bullet bills and cannons. You got all kinds of chomps. Some mm-hmm. that fly around at you. Some that are stationary. You've got piranha and nipper plants, which are those little white things that do that little chomping motion at you.
Yep.
The game's loaded with a bunch of... I mean, granted, like, the Koopas and Goombas probably make up half of the stuff you're going to see. But the other half is filled with all sorts of fun, cool, unique, new things. Again, keeping a bunch of great stuff from the original Super Mario Brothers and then adding a lot of inventive ideas.
You got the sun.
The sun? The sun, yeah. That's actually a throwback from Super Mario 2. Right? Really? Isn't the sun part of...
Is it?
Am I thinking of that right?
Doki Doki Panic? I don't remember.
I feel like the sun actually comes after you on one of the stages, where it, like, they're hovering those, in the corner and
they're the masks, the phantom masks.
Yeah, there's a mask. Maybe that's what I'm thinking of. Hmm. Maybe it's just a mask.
Which actually come back in Kirby Star Allies, the new Kirby game. There are phantoms. Oh, nice. I don't know if they're like called phantoms, but they're totally reminiscent of that. They're stationary masks that when you cross a certain point, they come after you.
Yeah. Okay, as for bosses, so you get the Koopa Kids, you're going up against the Koopa Kids. Mm-hmm. Every world ends with one of them, and they are, again, painfully generic.
Yep.
There are subtle variations, such as one shoots a rings at you that will disappear, some launch balls with each time they get hit.
Mm-hmm.
But essentially, you jump on their heads 3 times and they're done. And yep. Again, you can do the sort of thing where you time it such that they never even get a new attack off. You're just constantly tagging them over and over again.
Some of them are heavier and they'll stun you if you're on the ground when they jump out.
One of them uses like the ground shake thing that immobilizes you. But for the most part, same deal. The fortress bosses we talked about are shit.
Yeah, and again, I think the power up everyone sort of leans to is the ones that will give you a little bit of flight or hover. But if you enter a boss fight with a fire flower, they're toast.
Yeah, exactly. And Bowser himself is. I honestly think that this is, this has been for such a great platforming series. They've just never gotten these bosses very well.
No.
It's fun beating Bowser. The fight itself is not fun.
It's always been sort of an afterthought. Like, yeah. And instead of being like the candle on the cake, it's always just been like, all right, and this is the end. Just jump over and grab the axe.
Yeah.
It's fine.
Yeah, well, I don't even know what to compare it to. It would be like if you had a basketball game and you ended with fucking free throws or something.
Yeah.
Or it's like if your baseball game ends in a home run derby.
Yeah. I don't know. It doesn't... It has very little to do with the mechanics that you've been taught and tested on throughout the entire rest of the stage.
Yeah.
It's just, okay, now you're in an arena. Jump on its head.
Yeah. I mean, maybe they should have just looked at a fucking Mega Man game to see that the thing that sticks out. Because, I mean, I don't know about the platforming of Mega Man, but I remember the bosses pretty well. It's like, they kind of stick out.
Yeah, the platforming Mega Man is different from Mario because it's less about, like, making these acrobatic jumps, and it's more about running this gauntlet of enemies. Mm-hmm. Which, of course, feeds into the design of the boss fight because what you have to do is learn the attacks of the boss and how best to maneuver around it so you take less damage than he's dishing out.
Yeah. I don't know. Hard to find that healthy medium. I guess that's what makes Mario Mario and Mega Man Mega Man.
Yep.
So some final thoughts, just wrapping it up real quick here. You get an actual inventory, which is great. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
I still think Mario World perfects the idea. One, by limiting the items you have. There are very few items you can actually have in Mario
World. And you know, you talk about the inventory. There are a ton of items in there that, you know... It's functionality might be questionable. Like the music box will put your little roaming enemies to sleep for a few turns.
Which, by the way, if you're going to deal with roaming enemies, get a fucking star.
Yeah.
They're the perfect time to trigger your star.
Perfect use for a star.
Kill them. And you know what's going to come out of that special box?
A star.
A star.
It's great. Got another one for the next one.
Okay, great. You know.
Yeah,
you get the hover, the
cloud.
Yeah. It's like whatever.
I mean, that allows you to skip a level, which I guess if you're having a hard time, that's cool. But if you die, you're going to get sent back to before that level. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think you're doing yourself a little bit of a disservice if you're skipping over levels. Like, play these things. They're all really well designed.
And I've noticed that the game, also, I don't know if I mentioned this really earlier, but the game is actually pretty easy. Your average levels are pretty easy. The only time that, like, the first four worlds are a breeze. And that's even playing like I just did, where I'm beating every single thing.
I used to play this game where, I would always track my lives in increments of 10. Like, if I didn't beat World 1 without 10 lives, I was doing poorly. If I didn't beat World 2 without 20 lives, I was doing really poorly.
Yeah.
I just sort of tracked it up to World 8. Like, okay, got 80 lives. I'm set here.
There you go.
Like, this is...
Well, I noticed
sprint to the finish.
About the time you get to World 5, it's when there's a branching path and you only have to beat stage 4 or 5 or stage 6 or 7. It's that stage 7 or that stage 5 is tough, is genuinely tough, and can be a bit of a grinder where they're doing something that's kind of demanding of you. I know there's one, it's maybe the shortest stage in the whole game, but it's so tough because it is an auto-scroller that is going northeast, and it's all built around platforms.
Oh, sure.
The platforms, yeah, and your character is, again, so loose that you're not platforming as comfortably as you'd like. It's easy to get a little
overzealous,
and then about two-thirds of the way through... Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
Is this one of the ones where, like, the little chomps will appear and they'll spit fireballs at you?
Yeah.
Yep.
Just to fucking, you know, really twist the dagger.
And of course, and they scroll...
They make you panic, and you die. Like, that's a tough one. And
that's probably where the levels are genuinely the toughest, is when they're auto-scrolling and... You don't have a whole lot of real estate to work with, or the ground underneath you is collapsing.
Yeah. I also watched, you know, the Game Grumps?
Yeah.
They're these two streamer dudes. They're funny. I like them a lot. I think they can be a little overbearing at times, but I watched some of their Super Mario 3 runs just because I was playing it a bunch, and I was like, well, let me see these guys do it. One of them is a fucking rock star at it. He's a real pro. And the other is like, whatever, he does okay. And I noticed that the really good guy on the Game Grumps that's actually really, really good at it, he approaches the game so tepidly. When he's on a new area, he's tap-stepping forward. He never runs forward. He never just walks forward. He's constantly, like, moving into the frame to see what's about to happen. You know, he's so timid about it, and he's very good. I mean, he does it for a reason, because he beats all of these stages. Like, even the hardest ones there are, he usually gets on the first or second try. Like, he's very, very good at it, but at the same time, it's like, that's not really what I don't think Mario's supposed to play that way.
No, I think there should
be some fun and just dashing head on into the fray.
That's my general approach. Like, even if I've died like 5 or 6 times, like, nope, keep on running, keep going.
Just hop in there, man.
Bash your head against it so many times, and eventually you learn.
So I get, it makes these complex and sometimes really, really difficult puzzles. But really, it's not so much about a long, long map with a lot of platforming and running and jumping and doing all that. It's like very quickly figuring out game mechanics.
Mm-hmm.
Navigating your way through some potentially treacherous stuff.
So we talked a little bit about worlds. I just want to go back.
Sure.
Because you mentioned there's, of course, there's the fire world, there's the giant world, there's the ice world, and you mentioned, like, the world 5, so, like, the sky world.
We split world, yeah, where it's, like, around the bottom, and then you go up the spiral tower.
I really like world 7, which is, I guess, sort of, like, the pipe world. Where you have, like, a lot of these, like, pipe mazes that you have to go through, and then you get, like, vertical scrolling levels that wrap around, where... Like, you exit off the screen to the right and you appear on the left.
Those are great.
I really like that sort of thing.
Oh, and shit. Oh, my God. Thank you so much for bringing this up, because it reminded me of something in Celeste. When we were playing Celeste so much, there's parts where you got to jump on the platform and it changes the direction of where you're going.
Yeah.
That is a ripoff. That is a straight up stolen from Super Mario 3. Like, that is a game mechanic from Mario 3.
If you're going to steal from something.
And I think it's wonderful that they did that. And I'm sure, like, they got inspiration from all over the place with these old school platformers. But that's one where it's like, wow, what a great idea. Really well executed. Great, you know.
And Celeste takes it to another level, because you jump on it, you change the direction, you have to jump off and cling onto the side of it.
Ooh,
and tough. Ride it to the end. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and the worst that Mario 3 gets is sort of the idea that they're going to put you through paths with spikes above you, where it's like, go ahead, press jump. Do it, be daring.
You gonna jump? Now you're just gonna ride this till it disappears? Okay.
Yeah, it's like the fucking meme comic of the guy with the panel that says, don't push the button. He's just like, oh. He's like rubbing his brow. He's like, oh my God, I'm gonna push it. It's like, just don't do that. You're gonna be okay. Oh, yeah, good stuff. What else we got? Oh, man, one of the greatest little, not Easter eggs, it's there for you if you just look at it, but I love the sprite work on the king's before and after they get transformed.
Yeah.
Before they get transformed, there's these like adorable little monsters, one of which is the little baby dinosaur from Super Mario World.
Uh-huh.
You know, the one where it's like really big and then you jump on it and it gets really tiny and it bursts fire?
Yep.
One of those that. And then the kings afterwards are all uniquely designed. They're all different kings. Yeah, they look so cool.
There's more thought put into the kings than there are into the bosses. But they're all like sort of like representative of the world that they're in. Like the king of World 2 is like this pharaoh.
Uh-huh. Or the sultan dude. Or like the ice tower guy is the giant beard and all that. Like, it's a fun touch. It's good for people that dig it. I guess I don't know why I finished with my negative thoughts on the game.
There are none.
Ditch the timer. Points are meaningless.
Points are silly. Why? And that was also something like Super Mario Brothers 1. It continues in Super Mario World too. I can't remember when exactly they got rid of points. Mm-hmm. Maybe it was in Mario 64, but I think some of the 3D, I think 3D Land might have points. But why?
Did you know the coin chip? Yeah. I haven't unlocked it or anything like that, but it's like, the coin chip requires you to have your actual points, your currency, and something else all have to be 11.
Is that how it spawns?
Yeah.
I thought it was random. That's bizarre.
Yeah, and you have to have a series of 11s.
Huh.
So
your points, your currency, and
something else. I don't remember what it is. I think you have to beat a certain stage on a certain world with 11 seconds left or something. Jeez,
all right.
Yeah, I want to say, I mean, maybe it's not that complex. If it's something you've stumbled into without knowing the secret, that's a lot of random things to have to line up. But I'm pretty sure it is. It definitely had to have 11 coins and 11 on your in-game score. Maybe it's 11 lives and being on certain worlds. At any rate, and the game's flooded with these Easter eggs. Like, I was looking it up, and there's like 6 things I never even noticed in the game that are all like kind of deeply buried in it. And that's my last thought, is that the game is just a little too easy. I think it's, if you're just, like you said, I mean, it's easy to stack lives.
Yeah. You do run up a lot of lives. But I think that probably the benefit of tech there, where you can just kind of close your DS. But, you know, when you're 6-7 years old playing this game for the first time, like, it is actually difficult to play through it all in one sitting, because...
And that's actually why they give you the flutes too, right? Mm-hmm. To like skip ahead. So
yeah. But it can be quite a grueling gauntlet, because you don't have a save feature. You can't just walk away and come back later. You have to play it start to finish.
Yeah.
Which even though the levels are shorter, it's definitely a game that's longer than Super Mario 1. Because Super Mario 1, I mean, you have the benefit of
that's like 8 worlds, 4 stages.
Yeah.
The 4th stage is always a dungeon.
Mm-hmm.
And sure, some of this is skippable, but like, playing this mode here, I mean, this is maybe 3 hours of gameplay. Something like that, maybe. Just get where I am, beating every single thing. And I'm in the beginning of World 8. Yeah. I've been enjoying this game so much. It really is fun.
Yeah.
And it was an afterthought for me. I love Super Mario Brothers. I love Super Mario World. 2, I don't really care that much about. And 3 is like a game I played before, and I was like, oh, it's kind of fun. But lately, I've just gotten into it, man. This was like the perfect like video game fix for me. I've been wanting something like this. We're just like a fun, simple, quick game that's got a lot of depth to it if you look.
Good.
So, yeah.
So I think that'll bring this show to a close.
Yeah.
This episode of the Nintendo 64, where we talked about an NES game.
We got a little retro. Again, it's a retro game, I feel.
Yeah.
If anything, we should have talked about it back in, 2006 or whatever. Whatever the fuck that would have been, when this was legal drinking age or something.
But, I don't know, it's fine. We'll just do a sort of celebration of all sort of retro games. Like, I don't have anything to talk about Game Boy this month, but hopefully next month there'll be one or two things worth mentioning about the Game Boy, because it's often overlooked when we talk about retro games. Usually people focus on retro consoles rather than retro handhelds.
True.
And I don't know, we're not too far off from Game Boy Advance from being
the GBA.
From being the legal drinking age.
Are we going to talk about Pokemon Ruby?
Yes, eventually, but that
have you played any of those Pokemon games?
I've played a few. I dabbled. Yeah. I mean, I really like Gen 1. That's the game I played the most of. I never really beat the other ones.
Yeah.
Just Gen 1's the best. That's where it's at.
Yeah. I'm more of like, I played a little of Gen 1, went straight to Gen 9. The best stuff there is, man. Nah.
All right. But next up is the official show. We've got some games to talk about there. And then we do have a Pokemon show where we just talk about Gen 1 over
and over. Oh, that's what that is?
Yeah. Okay. I don't know what we're going to do this Pokemon show. Because last show we ranked the ice types.
I can fill you in on my run through that I'm doing. I've progressed quite a bit. Okay. I don't know, we can do another ranking. I think Wes had some ideas.
Oh, you know what? I think it was...
If he's not dead, he can totally...
Or not arrested from all those shenanigans in Austin that he was involved in.
Yeah.
But I think that he suggested ranking the fairy type, which I meant to go back and look at our archive to see if we've done that, because I don't think...
The fairy would be perfect, because you've got a mix of old and new.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But anyway... That's the end of this show. So until next time, everybody.
Sense. Yeah, all right. Later. We'll be right back.